So this is Inkstead CITR 101.9 FM. I'm talking to Sammy Harkham, the editor man behind the Kramer's Ergot, Book 7, best way to describe it, the modern day Sunday special for the who's who of the alternative cartoonists. And we have a whole bunch of stuff to talk about, though, because you're not just an editor, you're a cartoonist and a store owner and a movie lover.
Yeah. I'm a lover.
He's a lover of all things.
Yeah.
Now, there's a couple different ways we can go. We can talk about your early, getting into comics. We can start with that, or we can start with the Kramers and then get into more background stuff. How would you like to go? Why don't we talk about Kramer's first, actually?
Sure.
Where did you first start doing Kramer's? Like, why?
Kramer started out as something, it started out as a zine that I was doing in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that it was basically just me and assorted school friends and found stuff. And it was very similar to a zine that you'd get at a record store. Circa 1995, 96,
Fact sheet 5 styles?
It had maybe not even that good. Maybe it wouldn't even get listed in there. It was sort of interviews with bands and a little bit of comics and gross, disgusting medical images found from textbooks and just general buffoonery, and so it started as that.
Very high school sounding.
Oh yeah, totally, so it started as that, and then when I was in art school I decided to do it as a proper comic book, and they used to have these ads in the Comics Journal for this small publisher's co-op where you send in $500, you get 1,000 copies of your comic, and you have your only options are newsprint or white paper and two different, I think you could do a couple sizes, but there was a limit to how big it could be.
Mm-hmm. It's either digest or...
Yeah, and I was this will be a professional comic. That's what I want to do. I want to make a professional comic, and so we put the whole thing together and we got it back, and it was a super shock to the system just to see something printed and to see all your mistakes, to see drawings that look okay in your hands or on a computer screen,
mm-hmm.
but printed in a real thing, you really get a sense of whoa, this is really bad,
Was it of that low resolution computerized?
I think a lot of it, I could blame printing because the printing definitely was bad, but I think finally you can see your work with a little bit more objectivity,
mm-hmm.
And you could just see, whoa, I've got a long way to go. So, the first one was me and a couple other guys that I knew. And I think the work that they did is good. I still like the work they did. I'm not proud of anything I did in there. And it was definitely, a first go. And then the second one was done a year later. I think it's a little bit better. A lot of the same problems. You're sort of finding your footing, your sort of voice or whatever.
And is that and where then, you did most of your early cartooning was for that and the predecessors?
Sorry, say that again?
Most of your early cartooning, was it for specific, was like the stuff that you had done was just in the Kramers and the predecessors?
I mean, I'd done assorted of their minis and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But once I was doing Kramers, I was really trying to put everything in there that I was working on. But there were a lot of other things that I was doing separate from that that I ended up never publishing, you know? Either not finishing, or like I remember trying to, wanting to hit the Zarek grant deadlines, you know? So yeah. Working on 48-page books or whatever that were separate from Kramers, and either not hitting those deadlines and scrapping the work or realizing it was bad, whatever it was.
35 of 48 pages in or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, whatever, you know, stuff like that. None of it's good. I mean, occasionally I'll find it in my mom's basement, you know, in a binder, and I'll just be like, oh my goodness, you know. Like, thank God I didn't waste the postage. But, you know, and it sort of went along like that. And I think with the fourth one, that's when it really started to come together, and I realized, mm-hmm. like, that was... With the third one, I started asking cartoonists I didn't know. And then I think it turned out pretty good. I think there's a lot of good work in three. And then four...
And is that the first one that Anders is in?
Yeah, Anders is in the third one. I had gotten a copy of Big Questions number 3 at my local comic book shop, and I hadn't seen anything about it, never heard anything about it. You know, it was like totally just out of nowhere, and it remains to this day one of my favorite comic books ever, mm-hmm. you know? Because it just sort of came out of nowhere, and it was such a great issue. It's such a fantastic issue, that third issue. It's him, Zach Soto, Kathleen Lawley, Mark Furrier, a lot of good cartoonists. And I think it turned out pretty good. You know, it's not great. And then I thought that would be the end of it. And then with four, there were just... It seemed like all at once I was discovering all this great work, and I was like, you know, this could be really cool. Paul Hornschmeyer at that time was working as a printer for a printer called Westcan in Canada. And so he was the guy I was dealing with getting the third issue printed. So we became friends, and we were talking a lot, and he really was saying, like, you know, you could do a full-color book. There's a lot of things you could do that is possible, you know?
Yeah.
That seemed out of my realm before, and once I started thinking, like, oh, we could do a color book with all these great cartoonists, you know, it could be really, really something. And then I think with the fourth one, it started really coming together in my mind, you know, as far as having, like, it's sort of that thing of, like, when you're starting out, you're sort of doing you're making design decisions and artistic decisions that you think you should be making, but you may not totally feel, you know?
Yeah.
And with the fourth one, I started doing things in a way that just felt right, you know? And it just felt, like, honest in a way. And I don't think number four is perfect. I don't think it's even a great book, but I feel like it really was the start of something for me, you know? As far as an editor, as a cartoonist. And, yeah, I mean, then it's sort of... I don't know if it's grown. I feel like they're all different. You know, four mm-hmm. is more on the art side. I feel like five is a lot tighter than four, and it's much more focused on narrative cartooning, because that's where my head was when I did that one. Six, I think, is a good mix of both of those. And I felt like I was done in a lot of ways. Like, after six came out, I felt like so many of the cartoonists that I'd be interested in working with again, or that I love and I want to publish, had a lot of projects going on with other publishers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking that would probably be the end, at least for a little while. And then the Masters of American Cartooning show came to LA. And so I got to see original tear sheets, which I've never really looked at before. And seeing how this stuff was originally printed was like a real revelation, you know, looking at E.C. Cigar and Winsor McKay pages. And then roughly around the exact same time, I got a copy of the Nemo book in the mail. I had ordered it, and it arrived, and I was totally freaking out at this book, you know, and I realized that it could be really amazing to see modern cartoonists do this.
Yeah.
You know, but to do this now, to do this format, and it would almost be like a litmus test in a lot of ways, you know? Like, can we even do this? Like, will this even work, you know? And I was like, I'll set certain limitations, you know, 1 to 3 pages for the most part, and full color, and I'll try to ask, and I realized that I could sort of ask everybody. You know, I could ask all those cartoonists that were working with other publishers, because this was something special. This was going to be work that we probably wouldn't see otherwise. You know, like, they're really going to be making it with the book in mind.
It would be really hard to chop it up and throw it into another collection.
Exactly. You know, and even if it gets chopped up later on, it ends up somewhere else, it's like, it's going to make them think differently in as far as how they're going to approach the page, you know? So that was really interesting to me, and it made me realize, like, that would be a useful anthology. That wouldn't just be a retread. It wouldn't just be asking cartoonists that I've worked with before or cartoonists that we've seen a million times, you know? This would be something where we'd really be getting something new, you know? And that felt like a legitimate reason to spend the time and work on this book. And I was really excited. We weren't done with six. You know, we were close to being done with six. So this is, you know, 3 years ago almost.
Yeah.
You know? It's a long time ago. And so at that point, I just sort of ran down the list of everybody who I'd want. You know, and there's people in the book who I could finally ask who would make sense. Like someone like Jaime Hernandez or Kim Deitch. Like two cartoonists that I'm crazy about. But, you know, they're producing a lot of work. They're published often. You know, there's no reason to get them to give me a strip for an anthology normally. But for this, like, they're going to be thinking about it differently, you know?
Well, with Kim, it's quite interesting because that kind of made him look at comics a little differently for the way he was telling his story, because it was the chance to really blow it up and kind of take his story to another level, I guess, is what he was doing with it.
He's actually a very perfect fit for this, you know? Because his style of cartooning really echoes classic cartooning in many ways, you know?
Yeah, well,
it's really modern,
His artistic breakthrough, I think, came for him, like, as far as wanting to do cartooning, was seeing McKay Originals.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
It was an art show in New York in the 60s, and, you know, he saw that and went, okay, I really want to do comics. And
that's,
you know,
really interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like, to have him in there and to have young guys like CF or Jeff McManus, it was just like, felt really, really exciting. From an editorial standpoint, I was like, this thing could be fucking incredible. Or it could be really bad. Sorry, maybe I...
Don't worry, we're in Canada.
Oh, okay, good. So, you know, I thought this thing could be really great, and I got really excited about it. And, you know, I figured, you know, I'll ask a lot of cartoonists. We'll see what happens, you know? Because I knew that at that size, the book was, because of our print runs, I knew the book was going to be more expensive than a regular issue. And I knew then that it had to be tight. It had to be really tight. The work had to be incredibly strong, piece after piece. You know, it had to be something that was really worth it to do that at that size, and for the person buying it, you know, that it'd be something that they'd want to revisit. So, you know, I was thinking, wow, like, it's possible we'll end up with only 20 good pages at the end of this, you know? Like, who knows? And you know, and I figured I'll do it as, like, a nice newspaper, or I'll do it as, like, a print set, or I'll figure it out, you know? But it really just...
It's just got to be big.
Sorry?
It's just got to be big.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, because the interesting thing about it is, like, especially when you see Frank King's pages, it's like, they're simple strips. You know, they're simple in the sense of, like, simple layout, not too much text, not too much narrative. It's just, they're really breezy, they're really fun to read. But, and when you can read them at 8.5 by 11, you can read them on your computer screen. But when you blow it up and you look at it, the actual size that it was printed at, and you can look at that color and you can look at the content, it really breathes in a way that's very exciting and very foreign to, I think, you know, modern comics readers. So my feeling was, like, you know, we could have a whole range of approaches here. I mean, you don't have to have everything be super dense, where someone's jamming a 20-page story onto one page, or something that's visually crazy or exciting. You know, I mean, of course, that's nice, too. But you want to just have a wide range of material, and I think we ended up with that. I think it's got a really good range of material, you know, and I think it's a good cross-section of what's exciting now in comics, you know?
Well, it is quite neat how you're able to get such a cross-section, because it really seems like you tried to make sure not to follow it into any kind of set, I guess, style or genre, because then you're talking...
I mean, you make these decisions as, like, an editor to have everything sort of gel together nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is that makes something fit or not fit is hard to say. But, you know, you just want there to be a wide range of material where the whole is better than the parts.
Yeah.
You know? Like, ideally, that's what you hope from an anthology, is that everything works really well together. And I don't know exactly what it is. You know, I can't say it's like this kind of comics or that kind of comics. So you end up with a really wide range of stuff, but hopefully it's all a joy to read and to have next to each other. And they sort of strengthen each other, you know?
And
powers and numbers thing.
Well, it seems like the important part is that it's utilizing the media to its advantage as much as they can.
Sure.
It's like you compare, like, Josh Simmons, which was the, you know, that's, I don't know, 40-page story in three pages,
yeah,
with Frank Santoro's, which is this really lush, muted two-pager, which is not a lot of complex storytelling, but it's still, you know...
It's rich. It's rich.
Yeah.
It's worth revisiting. I mean, but that's what you want, you know? I think it would have been a mistake to tell everyone, like, I want really dense strips, you
yeah
know? It's like, you don't want a whole book of that, because I feel like that's not utilizing the page, you know?
No.
By having a whole book like that, you know? So you want to have everything sort of coming together. And, I mean, those two examples are perfect, you know? And I think Frank's thing is totally a joy to read, and Josh's thing is a total joy to read, but for completely different reasons, you
mm-hmm
know?
Now, we're talking about the size. Now, the format... I guess, taking a large cue from the Sunday Press books. Mm-hmm. When did you decide, like, time to go full hog into the fancy pages? And tell us about the paper that's used.
Well, once... well, if you know anything about Buenaventura Press, the people who publish the book,
mm-hmm,
they're, the guy at the head of that company, Alvin Buenaventura, he comes from a book background. Before he started doing comics, he was printing letterpress prints.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, he was working for a company where they did really small runs, deluxe artist books. So he's a real nerd when it comes to paper and inks and process. You know, God bless him, you know?
Yeah.
Because I'm much more slapdash in my approach to things, and he's really meticulous.
So there's a part
really,
of you...
Sorry?
There's a part of you that would have been happy just to have a big newspaper.
I mean, I guess so, you know, but, I mean, no, the thing is that totally, I know what I want, I don't know how to get it done,
mm-hmm,
Alvin knows how to get it done, you know, and so with this, it was like, okay, this thing's going to be expensive, like, no matter, we didn't know how expensive, but we knew it was going to be way more of a production than the last one, you know, so that starts opening things up. With the previous issues, we always felt like things were slightly dark, that things printed slightly dark.
Yeah.
So we really tried to find a paper that had the brightness and pop of a good glossy paper.
Yeah.
Without the bright sort of gloss of glossy paper, you know, so it didn't feel like a giant magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And we found a great paper called New Age that is considered glossy stock, and it is glossy, but it has something special to it, and it feels really nice, you know? And that was a big decision, and we sort of went back and forth on it endlessly by using, like, wood-free unglossy paper or using a glossy paper. And I felt like, you know, I feel like since High Water sort of introduced this idea of non-glossy, and it was such a fresh approach to publishing, you know, when the first High Water books were coming out in the late 90s, it was the first time you were really looking at comics as, like, art objects.
Yeah.
You know? They really felt like...
they can do more
with... that was the piece of art.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It wasn't, like, looking at the original. It was, like, the actual book was the piece of art. For me, I mean, that's where it starts. You know, I was 16, 17, first time seeing that stuff that Tom Devlin, the publisher of High Water, was doing. And it was very inspiring. But I feel like since then, everything's been on non-glossy paper because it has a more warm feel.
Well, I guess it helps that he works for Drawn and Quarterly now.
Yeah, well, totally. I mean, I think it works for most books.
Yeah.
You know? Because it definitely gives it this... it feels... there's something warm about it. There's something that brings you closer to the work in some way. You know, glossy can make things a little bit cold. So, you know, we really struggled with that. That was like a big thing. It probably sounds really stupid, but for us it was like a super big decision. The paper was expensive, but we were like, you know what? The work will look amazing.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, we printed stochastically, which is a different way. Usually there's a line screen, there's a set dot pattern,
yeah,
and you print a four-color process. With stochastic, it gives it a random dot pattern. The ink is laid down in a different way, and it gives it just that little bit of punch. It looks like it gives it that little bit, a bit of oomph, you know?
Yeah.
A bit of a kick in the butt, just tiny bit better, you know? So, like, that was something where I knew printing that way on this kind of paper, also it brought down the gloss slightly, printing stochastically.
Mm-hmm.
Stochastic was only really used up until computers. It was only used in high-end fashion magazines for fashion spread because it was really really cost a lot of money to do, and now with computers it's a little bit easier, but it was still a nightmare. I mean, the printer of this book, TWP, they really put themselves through the ringer trying to get this book done. Alvin Buenaventura went to Singapore to do a press check. You know, he overstayed for a week trying to get everything right. It was a major, major struggle, you know, because we didn't know when starting out, like, okay, we're going to do a great big book, and we're going to print it this way, and we're going to do it on this paper. You know, he gets to Singapore, and it's actually incredibly difficult on every level, you know, and there were mistakes made on every level on the printing side,
mm-hmm.
you know. But we got the books in time. We hit, you know, the deadline of getting them for the Alternative Press Expo. So it all turned out okay in the end. But it was definitely tough. I mean, they're bound by hand, for God's sake.
They're sewed together, right? All the pages.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, just to get the books cut, you have to take it to a whole other plant, you know, and the cloth had to be special ordered. And it was just a really big ordeal, you know. It was super mega. And I think if we knew at the time going in, we might have paused for a second, like, do we really want to do this? Because no one's making a lot of money from a book like this.
No.
You know? You're doing it out of a love of books and a love of comics. But in the end, you know, you get the book and all that stuff washes away. I completely forgot. Right when I saw the book, I completely forgot about all that, you know? I mean, of course, I regret a million other things. But none of it has to do with the struggle of putting together the book, you know?
You've got a right to have your doubts with a soul like me about. When a power I'll plant seeds and watch them die. I'll bring honey from on high, and I'll even give the lightning bolts their turn. I won't be burned. I won't be burned. I will lock in lion's den without concern. I will hold the olive branch between my
It must be quite a relief to hold it in your hands.
Well, it's a relief that nothing is super fucked.
Yeah.
So that's good. But as, I mean, anytime you work on a project for a really long time, you know, you never get the book back and go, oh, that was worth it. You know?
Yeah.
Like, that was 3 years well spent. You know what I mean? Like, you stare at this work for so long that it doesn't mean anything. You know? Like, I can't really gauge the book, but there's other things that I'm really excited about. I mean, the thing that struck me when I finally got a copy was that it works.
Yeah.
That this book makes sense, and that it doesn't feel indulgent. That everything reads really well, you know? And that, like, I was right, you know? That I was fucking right. Like, the whole thing was a good decision.
Eat it, haters.
You know? Sorry?
Eat it, haters.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just, like, for myself, just for myself. Like, I know, I think it's a good book. You know, I guess what I should say is that I'm as happy as I can be with it, you know, as one can be with anything that they do and spend a long time on. You know, I think I'll probably be able to read it properly in about a year.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a super cool book. That said, I'm like, man, this book is so cool.
It is, and like I've heard from some people that have managed to get their grubs on their grubby hands on some copies, and it's just everything I'm hearing is just fantastic. So I'm looking forward to
good.
To you know regular shipping for folks that don't live on one of your tour locations.
Yeah, well, look, there's deals to be found online.
Yeah, no, I unfortunately had to resort. So. Tell us a little bit about the tour that you're about to be embarking on.
Well, with the book, early on, I realized that, you know, with Barnes & Nobles and Borders and Amazon, these booksellers, they undercut themselves.
Yeah.
You know? They sell the books at a loss.
Yeah.
You know, and I hate that. I think it's fucked. I think it's unfair to independent booksellers. And I feel like there's been retailers who have always supported Kramer's, have always supported the projects that I've worked on. And I knew that this was going to be a hard sell, regardless, for comic book stores, you know? I think it could do better in, like, an art bookstore or something. And I wanted to help out as much as I could, you know? And I figure a tour is a really good thing to do. Like, the last time I did a Kramer's tour was for issue 4.
Yeah.
And that was the same thing. It was like, you know, no one really knew the book at all, even though I had done 3 issues. It was $25, which at the time sounded like so much money.
Yeah.
And the tour, like, we didn't have, like, lines around the block. You know, a lot of them were very meager. But it creates a sense of energy that sort of stays in that place for a while, you know?
It pumps you.
Yeah, and like, you know, it's like we might only sign 10 copies, the store takes 20, but for the next couple of days, there's like a pile of those books there, you know? And everyone who comes into the store knows that, you know, that there was a signing here for that event, you know, that they didn't go to or whatever it is, you know? And I just wanted to, I thought we should definitely do something like that for this one, you know? I think the book is going to do well regardless. But I thought this will be just that extra little push for those stores that are, you know, always been really supportive. Of course, there's more stores that we would like to do. We're only doing, I think, 10.
Yeah.
Either in like 9 or 10 shops. I'd like to do more. I'm not doing any on the West Coast.
I noticed.
I want to, but time, you know, totally permits that. So, you know, we're starting in Baltimore. We're going to. At Atomic Books.
And
then we're going to Copacetic has set something up at a place called Brillo Bar in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to New York to Desert Island Comics in Brooklyn. And then we're going to the a bookstore called, I think, Ada Books in Providence. And then we're going up to the Drawn and Quarterly store in Montreal, Beguiling in Toronto, and Chicago Comics in Chicago. And then I think five or six of us doing the entire tour, and then we're picking up and dropping off people as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
So at any one of these stops, there's going to be, you know, 7 or 8 cartoonists. So that's good.
It's going to be a bunch of you in a car, or are you guys going to be flying across and then driving?
We're all flying into Baltimore.
Okay.
And then driving the rest of the way.
And then it's going to be it's going to be what, you, Ron Rigi,
me, John... Ron Rigi, John Pham, Kevin Huizenga, and then Souther Salazar is meeting up with us in Providence, and he's doing a big chunk. He's doing the rest from Providence on. Sherry Boyle is doing two stops. CF is doing two stops. Matthew Thurber, I think, might be coming down to Pittsburgh as well as doing New York. New York, there's like 15 or 20 cartoonists. Adrian Tumine, Gabrielle Bell, Kim Deitch, Jerry Moriarty. I mean, the list goes on and on. In Providence, there's about all the Providence guys. Chicago, probably Chris Ware, Ivan Brunetti.
Mm-hmm.
Toronto, Seth, Sherry Boyle. Good list, a really good list.
Yeah,
of people.
It's fantastic.
A lot of people that normally don't do signings too, so it should be really cool. It should be really good, and you know, it'd be nice to drive around. It's early December; shouldn't be too cold, you know.
And didn't you
find some weird bars
for the other Kramer's tour? Wasn't it in the heart of winter?
It was.
And you did like Minnesota?
No, that was summer.
Okay.
I did a winter tour with Anders Nilsson and Kevin Huizenga.
Okay.
When we all had comics that were coming out. When Crickets was just starting and Big Questions was just now being published by Drawn and Quarterly, and when Or Else was just starting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. I could be wrong, but I think we all just were new D&Q guys. And that was in the dead of winter, and that kind of sucked.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how to drive. Snow. I'm from California. But
Rita,
you know,
read the old Henry Rollins tour diaries for everything not to do on a tour.
But then I have to read Henry Rollins.
Yeah. Sometimes it's fun to hear about some guy sitting by himself whining, and you know, I don't know, maybe not.
I think Mike Watt talks about like having a pee jar on tour and then drinking it after a couple weeks, like leaving it in the sun.
Oh.
And then you can drink it after 2 weeks. I don't know why he's touring in places where they don't have water, but, you know, it'll be really fun.
Yeah.
I'm excited. You know, I mean, we all are sort of sitting at our drawing tables, sort of talking through email and occasional phone calls. So it'll be nice to get together and, you know, go crazy for 10 days.
How was the launch at your shop yesterday?
Yes. We did a signing last night at Family, and it was 11 of us. Do you want to see if I can name them all quickly?
Let's see. I'm counting.
Matt Groening, Jeff McFetridge, Tim Hensley, Souther Salazar, Josh Simmons, Jaime Hernandez, Martin Sindrita, John Pham, Walt Holcomb, and myself.
I got 10.
Dude,
don't worry.
Who am I forgetting?
Yeah.
He doesn't matter. Whoever I'm forgetting sucks.
It is a bit of a dude fest, I gotta say.
Well, on the tour, not in the book. Let's see, is it a dude fest? Sherry Boyle did the back cover, and she's got a 2-page strip. Anna Summers is in the book.
Yeah,
Carol Tyler is in the book.
And Gabrielle Bell.
Gabrielle Bell is in the book. That's pretty good. There was one cartoonist, female cartoonist I wanted in the book, who said no. And yeah, I don't know. What can I tell you?
Bugging.
Girls suck. No, I mean, you know, there's some, you know, I don't know.
It happens.
I don't think. No, but as an editor, you hear that a lot, and I never really know. I figure I just have to go with the work that speaks to me and not try to hit certain things. Like, I got to have this many black dudes, this many mulattoes, this many Jews, you know? I mean, maybe everyone's like Irish Catholic. I have no idea.
Well, it's, No, that's the point. One problem with a lot of anthologies that try and do specific groups of people is that they tend to fail miserably because they're not about the work, but about the...
About the community.
Yeah. And,
yeah, I mean, I figure, you know, I owe the reader. Like, mm-hmm. I'm in service of the reader. That's it. That's the only person I should be thinking about is the imaginary reader and making sure they get a book that's excellent. And so I guess sometimes there's people you might know locally that you don't include that makes for awkward conversation once in a while, you know?
That happens to every editor.
At the end of the day, you have to just publish the work that you really respond to. And I think as an editor, if you're a good editor, it's not even a matter of including everyone you like. Because I like all kinds of comics, you know,
yeah,
by all kinds of people. But it's a matter of things fitting a certain way. It's what we were talking about earlier, you know?
Mm-hmm. You may be the only one that likes it, and that'll be a problem.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Your other stuff, Kramer's is one part, and then, but you, your own separate comics, Crickets and Somersault. Tell me about starting out Somersault, one of my favorite strips.
Somersaulting.
Yeah.
I
love it, and I can't even say the right name. It's a failure on my part.
Research.
It's called The End of Semester at School. Yeah, you don't want to know the homework I'm doing right now.
It's called Rock Band.
I don't play video games. I know.
It's called Crossword in the New York Times.
Yeah.
It's called Too Much Pornography.
There we go. I am good friends with Robin Bougie.
Right. Oh, so there you go. That's not even porn. That's like a whole other level of living.
Yeah.
Seeing the world.
It is. We went on a trip to New York together, and that's a story for another day.
That's awesome.
So Somersaulting. Now, why the choice to publish to have your stuff in other publishers, yada yada, not publishing it yourself? Like obviously, Drawn and Quarterly is a great avenue to be publishing through. Like, tell me about where the story came from and why the choice.
I never looked at Kramer's as this place where I was always going to be forever. Mm-hmm. You know, I even look at it as something where if I do future issues, I could stand back and not be in it at all, you know? And when Drawn and Quarterly got in touch with me, it was like a mega shock. You know, I've been reading those comics as a teenager since I was a kid. And, you know, of course, like, everything that they were publishing when I started reading alternative comics totally formed me as a cartoonist. So when Chris Oliveros, the publisher, got in touch with me, it was like a no-brainer, you know? I said yes right away. Of course, I was kind of terrified.
Yeah.
Because it was the first real thing that was getting published by someone else, you know? And with that story, it was sort of... Somersaulting is, you know, about... maybe a month in the life of these teenagers who just sort of hang around and don't really do much. And it's sort of about all these small little details, all these little moments that sort of build up, hopefully, into a whole. And, you know, I had just done Poor Sailor, which has a really tight narrative, is really plot-driven, is really tight.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do something that sort of rambled around a little bit. And so that strip... was, you know, came out of that desire to do something like that. And it was something where I would draw scenes individually on, like, I would just do a scene sort of separate from everything else, and then I would do an image, you know, just a little, I mean, I had like a little square piece of cardboard because I wanted all the panels to be the same size,
mm-hmm.
that I used as a template, and I would just fill it with just all these little details and tangents. And as I worked on it, you know, a narrative started forming, and I wanted the plot to sort of happen in the background.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was sort of behind everything that you didn't even realize it was building up to something, you know? And, so yeah, that was like a 21-page story, pretty dense. I was trying to make it in such a way that I didn't want all these little moments to read as big moments, you know? Big soaring scenes where everything is very precious.
Yeah.
So I condensed it. So it was, I think it's 9 panels on a page, and maybe it's printed in that book. Maybe it's a little small, you know, considering how big the drawings were. But I wanted it to, so that you just sort of read through it, you know. Is it successful? I don't know. But it was a good thing for me to do at that time, you know. I don't really hear much about it from readers, so I don't know if it was a successful story, but as far as process, it was great for me as a writer, as a cartoonist, you know. And then once we'd done that, I think Chris really liked it, Chris Oliveros, I think mm-hmm. he was really happy with it. And so he asked me if I wanted to do a series. And I had sort of been planning in my mind to do a series that I figured I would just do as a mini comic, you know. And when he asked me, I was very excited because, you know, it was exactly what I was wanting to start doing anyway, you know. And that's what, you know, comic books has really always been a huge, huge inspiration, like that, the quarterly, annual, whatever it is, that thing of like 8-Ball, Frank, Jim,
yeah,
you know, Love and Rockets, like Acme, 30 Plot, Peep Show. I mean, I could go on forever, you know, those things. I was like, that's what I really respond to, that's what I wanted to make as a kid. Like, when I was discovering comics, there weren't that many graphic novels, you know. There was collections, and they were always ugly, you know.
Yeah.
They were really badly put together collections.
Blocky printing. Yeah.
Yeah, bad printing, bad design. Just, it looked weird. It always looked weird to me.
That bad Fantagraphics. The bad Fantagraphics 80s house style.
Yeah, totally. I would just, you know, Peppy White or whatever. I mean, it was all like, for me, there was the interesting thing about comics, as opposed to like movies or books or whatever, was that like you'd get a single issue of, let's say, 8-Ball, and there was such an amazing mix of content,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that was very, very inspiring. And like, that's something that I find you could only get in comics. So that for me is like a mega, that's the goal, you know, is to have a really good comic book series. I mean, of course, nowadays, with the way the comic industry works, I don't know how long I'll be able to do a series for Drawn Quarterly, but they're indulging me so far, you know? And I'm okay with low print runs and them just printing enough to make their money back. I'm okay with them going out of print. And I figure they're just, you know, publishing these as a favor to me. You know, I mean, they all sell. I think Crickets does fine.
Yeah.
But there isn't big bucks there. And I figure they're just waiting for the collection. Eventually we'll have either a graphic novel from one of the, something that's being serialized, or a collection of short stories or something.
Yeah.
Know?
Well, it
and
seems
God
like you have a couple different stories you're working through with that. Like, how far is the Gollum story you expecting to go?
I have no idea. I figure that strip is sort of in the tradition of Ed the Happy Clown or Velvet Glove Cast in Iron, you know? The tradition of cartoonists just going, just sort of
where it takes you,
speaking before they're thinking, you know.
Yeah,
just plowing forward and seeing where it goes. I don't think it's going to be that long, but I definitely have something for the next issue, and that's definitely not the end, you know. So at least another 40-50 pages at least. I don't want to shoot myself in the foot and say like it's going to be 500 pages and we're going to finish by Crickets number 10, you know.
And it'll be a monthly series.
Yeah, you know, I'm just working on it. And I've got, you know, after the first issue, I really wanted to have a lot more mixture of stuff. So the first issue is all Black Death material. The second issue is, it's actual page numbers. The second issue is still a lot of Black Death.
With
only a couple pages for other stuff. But I think the other stuff is super dense that it reads like it's half the issue. In my mind, it's half the issue is non-Black Death stuff.
And it's more, it seems like you're having more fun with the other stuff, too.
Mm.
Like, I guess it's a chance to kind of take a rest from the, I guess, the whole Black
Death. Well, you know, it's like, I think a lot of it has to do with just drawing smaller panels, you know? There's only so much mood that you can get across, and how much, like, how much of the milieu you can put in the reader's brain, you know? I'm really proud of that material. I think Crickets 2 is probably the best thing I've ever done, even though it's full of a lot of insider jokes and a lot of, like, nerdy stuff. I figure the people buying this are people who are going to the comic book store.
Yeah.
So that's material that I may not ever put in a book collection, you know, but I think works for a comics reader.
The Gary Panter story is worth it alone.
God bless Gary Panter. Yeah, no. You know, stuff like that where I feel like comics readers can get it, you know, more than the average, like, buyer at Barnes & Noble's or something.
Did you get much flack for
it? Yeah, I mean, the shorter stuff is, it's definitely you know, it's really fun to work on that stuff. It's a real shift in approach for me, you know, and it's really opened up my mind. Like doing strips like that, like Napoleon, Alicia, again, it's all about process, you know.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed making those strips. And you stop thinking about how long something is taking, and you're just enjoying working and getting stuff done. Even those, like some of those pages would take a couple weeks. You're not worried about output. You're like, this is good. I'm really enjoying this, and it keeps you excited about making work. You know, writing as you go, and you know, I find like with comics, the most enjoyable way of working on them is to sort of have an outline, an idea, and just get to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and let stuff sort of develop as you go. And that's been very helpful for, you know, if I end up working on a graphic novel or newer strips, or it helps Black Death, anything, like all those tiny little strips, like the stuff like Gary Panner, totally influences how I work on proper, quote-unquote, proper stories.
I don't know if I like that term, proper stories.
Yeah, it's a bad term. I don't really know how to phrase it, you know?
Did you get much...
Smaller.
Did you get much flack for some of your stuff in that one? In the Crickets 2?
Yes.
Okay. Just wondering. We don't need to go into it here.
Yeah, let's not.
Some forgiveness, but begging's not my business. And she won't write a letter, though I always tell her. And so it's my assumption I'm really up the junction.
In your own kind of getting into comics and stuff, what were some kind of seminal influences and things that really changed how you looked at comics and what you could do with it?
Well, you know, it's one of those weird things where I always think it's one thing, and then I'll be going through like a back issue bin at a comic book convention and find something else that was like totally important to me that I've forgotten about, you know?
Yeah.
That being said, you know, I think Rubber Blankets number 3 and 1. I could never get an issue of 2. I finally got an issue 2, but I reread Rubber Blankets 1 and 2 maybe like, you know, dozens of times, hundreds of times.
Yeah.
You know? Big Man.
Yep.
Oh, it's one of the Mist, all that stuff.
They're perfect
Dead
books.
Dead Dog. Sorry?
I think that they're perfect books, the Rubber Blankets.
Yeah,
they're
perfect.
Fabulous.
They're perfect. I mean, as you read them, it's like there's times when I'm like, is this good? Like, I don't even know anymore. I've read this so many times, but it really speaks to me. You know, I really, really, and I think it's interesting because I think what Mazzucchelli does, if someone else was to draw those comics, they could be boring and pretentious.
Yeah.
But there's something in his line, like just the way he puts down these images that makes them so rich and so incredible. I'm very excited for his new book.
Yeah,
so
as we all.
Yeah, I mean, the guy is amazing. So I'd say Mazzucchelli and probably Chester Brown.
Yeah.
Is another, like, huge one. Huge, huge, because it's like reading a story like Danny. I think it's called Danny. Or it's just a strip about him, like, getting up in the morning, listening to the radio, and talking to his neighbor.
Yeah.
Was like, really, I'd never really come across anything like that. I guess, you know, if I was a little bit older, maybe reading Harvey Pekar would have done the same thing, you know? But to read a strip where it was really just about someone's daily existence was very exciting.
There's something...
And I Never Liked You, it's like that, reading that book. When I started reading Chester Brown, he was already doing Underwater.
Mm-hmm.
So I had bought his books. And those were nice books. Like, I Never Liked You, I bought in the Playboy. And I Never Liked You was a book that I was reading as a teenager, you know? And it spoke to me, like, as I was living that life. You know what I mean?
Which,
like,
is exactly what he's trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, I could relate to it on such an intense level. You know, I guess a lot of kids could, you know? It was just such a amazing thing to see someone doing a story that... is so simple, you know? A handful of panels per page, very little narration, just really simple storytelling. He's not knocking your socks off with anything crazy.
Maybe a couple of things.
Sorry?
Maybe a couple of things.
Well, yeah. The work's amazing. And I think he's, formally, I think he's a genius as well. But I think it's not all on the surface. It's not so obvious. You know, like, you can give I Never Liked You to anybody and they can read it and feel it, you know?
Yeah.
And so Chester Brown was like a huge, huge, huge influence. And I still reread all his work often. You know, I'm always going back to that stuff. I mean, there's something about his line, his sensibility, the whole thing just really resonates for me.
Well, when you were talking about the in Somersaulting, how you're doing it panel by panel, that just totally, like, made me think of that issue of Yummy Fur.
It's very similar. I guess he still works one panel per page and just tapes them up together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Chester Brown is probably the biggest influence on me as an artist, but it's at a level where, like, I don't know. I mean, occasionally people say, like, oh, this drawing that you did looks like Chester Brown, or this feels like Chester Brown. And it doesn't bother me because I know I'm not, like, looking at it as I'm drawing.
Yeah.
I'm trying to recreate the same emotion that he is, or the same tone that he is, you know? I feel like it's just totally been absorbed and it's coming out in however way it's coming out. You know, but I'd say, like, Chester, Mazzucchelli, you know, the Acme. I mean, it was all that stuff that was coming out in, like, the mid to late 90s. It was coming out pretty regularly.
Yeah.
You know, you can get a new issue of Frank. I mean, Frank blew my mind. Dirty Plot. I mean, all this stuff. All the stuff that, you know, I was getting 00. I was reading I think the Comics Journal, you know, it used to be really amazing. It used to be a great magazine. I know if you say it to someone now, they may not even know what the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah.
But at one time, the Comics Journal was this amazing magazine. And I think that magazine really formed how I looked at comics in a lot of ways. You know, I think that was a huge influence.
Well, it's
as much as any actual comic.
Is that how you got into a lot of the East Coast stuff? Because you're in LA, and you've been pretty much in LA the whole time, I guess, as a you know, growing man. And was that your opening to a lot of like the Fort Thunder type of stuff?
Fort Thunder. Well, the Journal was already starting to fall off by that point. I mean, the last editor they had was probably Milo George, and he did. I think one of the last issues he did as editor was a Fort Thunder issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was a long time coming.
Yeah.
If what I heard was correct, I think he'd wanted to do something for a while. I mean, I discovered that stuff. I was very lucky. There's a good comic shop in LA called Meltdown.
Yeah.
So Gaston, the guy who runs that shop, I remember, you know, I would go in every week to the comic book store, and he gave me a Matt Brinkman mini comic. Gave it to me, and I was like, what is this? You know, because it sort of resembled Frank in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And it didn't resemble Frank in a lot of ways, and it was, like, totally off the radar.
This whole other world.
So exciting. And, you know, that was really amazing. And I think he was then in Comics 2000. Matt Brinkman had a strip in there. And I discovered Paper Rodeo really late, you know. And then I think Kevin Huizenga was talking about Ben Jones. I think I met Kevin, and he was talking about Ben Jones, saying this guy's, like, you know, a genius. Ben Jones is part of Paper Rat. And so I got in touch with him, and Ben Jones and Joe Grillo, another guy from Providence, they have stuff in Kramer Zergot 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you slowly, people start sending you stuff. You start sending stuff to people, and you sort of find that stuff, you know? That stuff was harder to find.
Yeah.
I think the Journal was just super good for me as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, like reading a 60-page interview with Stephen Bissett, you know?
Yeah.
And just hearing cartoonists talk about their process and their lives and art and living was just super exciting. And reading really long, in-depth reviews, well-written reviews, you know, it was really interesting. It was really exciting for a young guy. I've been lucky as far as, like, living in L.A., there's a handful of really good comic book stores. So there's always been stuff to find, you know? As far as mini comics, you know, I went to Alternative Press Expo when I was in high school. I remember going, taking the drive up there, and that was like a total, like, mind-melting experience, discovering all these mini comics,
yeah.
You know? Wow Cool and John P. and all that stuff was, like, huge for me. Like, well, a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, it's a good entry time, I think, because you've missed the whole black and white boom
right,
and crap.
Well, all that stuff, my older brother was a big comics fan. So, like, a lot of comics that are, see what we were saying earlier about, like, forgetting about influences.
Yeah.
As a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, I was reading, like, hamster comic?
Oh, yeah, Adolescent Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters,
there
I think
you
it
go.
Was.
There
yes,
you go.
Yes, I worked
so
in
I
a comic
like,
store.
He would buy me comics, and I would go with him to the comic book store, and those are the comics that I like to buy. You know, one of the first comics I got to buy on my own was a Neil Adams comic. I didn't know who he was. I'm just saying, like, looking at a whole wall of comic books.
Yeah.
There was a Neil Adams comic, I think it's called Armor.
Ooh.
Right? And I didn't know what it was. My dad didn't even browse. He just stood in the doorway. Like, it was like, you know, it was like going to be like a special dad and son afternoon.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm going to pick you up from school, which is weird. Like, it's weird. If your dad never picks you up from school, it's weird to have your dad, like, in the schoolyard. You're, like, embarrassed, and you feel weird, and you don't know why. We went to the comic book store, and, like, he was like, I'm going to let you buy a comic. Go buy one. And I was super excited. I must have been, like, in first or second grade. And he just stood in the doorway. And now as an adult, I'm like, he was roughly my age.
Yeah.
You know? He wouldn't have been much older than me. And I'm like, the guy didn't even want to look at anything. Like, he wasn't interested in anything at all. You know? He just stood there. And I felt really awkward. And I quickly just, like, looked through the shelves and I grabbed this comic Armor because it looked cool, you know? Because there was lots of, like, blades and stuff.
And
like,
lots of hyper colors.
Yeah, insane. Insane. And I remember going home and reading this comic, and it ends. I've never seen it since, but all I remember is that it ends with the main character, Armor, being captured, and he blacks out, and when he wakes up on the last page, both his arms have been cut off. And that was the end. I guess it was, like, to be continued, but both his hands had been chopped off, you know?
So like, six-year-old Sammy...
comics were totally connected to this really subversive, insane... Like, I totally connected it to, like, horror movies, like Toxic Avenger.
Yeah.
Which I guess is a comedy, but it's to a six-year-old... You know, because I had an older brother. He's into, like, punk rock and horror movies, you know, and skater magazines. And for me, comics was totally in that realm.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that I've totally blocked out, and I'm only recently starting to realize, like, all this, like, I connected comics because I was, those are the kind of comics I was looking at. I connected it to, like, horror movies and punk music, whatever that means, you know, to a six-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, looking at Reagan Youth covers and pig face posters and puss head, big puss head, like, bill posters and stuff. You know, and because the comics that I was seeing, I remember another one I bought was like a Frankenstein comic that ended with a female Frankenstein, like a Bride of Frankenstein, being created, and in the last spread, she exposes her tits, and she's got humongous mutilated tits. You know, I'm like 6 years old, but you know, like I grew up in a house, six of us.
Yeah.
In siblings. I've got five siblings. So there's six kids. My parents cannot keep track of what everyone is doing, you know? And my brother had, like, Zap comics and Von Bode comics and, you know, Dead World was another one.
Oh.
You know, I remember just staring at those Dead World covers of, like, screaming skulls. Did you ever see those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I'm very familiar.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, and I think... I mean, that's what comics were in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, I never was interested in Marvel comics. I remember just feeling like all that stuff was boring. I always wanted stuff that looked kind of crazy or nutty. I mean, it's totally stupid,
yeah.
You know, to look for the comics that have the most blood in them. But I loved all that stuff. I remember being like, when I was like 11, I went to a local comic book convention and bought a couple issues of Faust. You know, like some guy would sell this to an 11-year-old. And I remember taking it to summer camp the next day and giving it like bring it to summer camp,
little show and tell,
it off to different kids, and then they would go to the bathroom and read it in the stall, you know. Yeah. And they're not even reading it, they're just looking at pictures of like severed heads with like giant ding dongs,
yeah,
dripping all over them, you know. But yeah, as far as the stuff that's probably influenced my work, I would like to think it's the smarter stuff, you know, like Chester Brown.
The fancy answer.
Kelly.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dan Clowes and stuff.
Oh, so many terrible comics, the Dead World and the Faust. And
it's unbelievable, right?
It's,
I mean, Faust, I'm still figuring that one out. I mean, I still look at that comic like, is this bad? Is this good? What is this? It's like amazing prison art or something. Vigil, I got to meet him at a comic book convention. I was so excited. He looked like a drunk from Kentucky. It was unbelievable. He had a Batman story that he drew for fun that had the Joker anally raping Harlequin pain off her back. It was like it was insane. It was so weird. And Batman had this humongous dong. And I said, "What is this for?" He said, "I'm just drawing it for fun." amazing. There's an essay Gary Groth needs to write about Faust and Tim Vigil's whole career. That's, you know, that'll turn the Comics Journal around, I think.
What would happen to Victor Caro if he lived in the southern states, I guess?
Yeah, right? And, like, was lobotomized.
Yeah.
You know, I think Victor is, like, the amazing thing about Victor is that I think he's pretty smart.
He is.
You know, I think he's really smart. But yeah, totally. If you lobotomized Victor Caro and you only had Megadeth playing and he lived in a strip club, you'd have Faust. Something similar to Faust.
Well, we better take care of Victor so that doesn't happen.
Maybe we shouldn't so it does happen.
Just
Tim Vigil only has, you know, couple more decades left in him.
If so that. It's a lot of hard living in the 90s.
Yeah, totally.
Now, you shared studios with Jordan Crane for a while, right?
I did, and then he moved to the other side of town. That relationship is no more.
Oh. How did that influence sharing the space with Jordan? Because, I mean, here's a guy that was...
He's like a real smart guy. You know, mm-hmm. Jordan's real smart. He draws, for your listeners who don't know, Jordan Crane draws a comic called Uptight, an anthology called Non. Jordan was one of the first cartoonists I became friends with.
Yeah.
He moved to L.A. like in 2001 or 2002, and, you know, he was always really nice when I'd show him my terrible work, and he would, you know, hang out with me and teach me shit. So, you know, it's good having Jordan, because Jordan's always going to tell you what he thinks.
Yeah.
And he's always going to call you on your bullshit. So in that way, it was good having him around. You know, in the ways that it was bad to share studio space, it's bad in all the ways that you'd think, you know? Sometimes it's good to have space to yourself, to just worry about your own work, not talk to other people, you know, all those things. But it was good. And right now, actually, John Pham has moved up into the studio. So it's both of us here.
Who has a new book out from Fantagraphics called Sublife.
Yeah, called Sublife.
And he is in the Kramer's book.
So. He is. He did one of my favorite strips in the whole book.
Which I look forward to reading when I can have it on paper.
yeah, it's good. He did a great strip. I love it. And it's good. You know, me and John, we've got our schedules are perfect because it's like I'm here till 5. He comes in around 4 or 5 o'clock. So there isn't that much overlap. We get to talk for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to destroy the space when he's not up here. He's amazing. John Pham. He's like God. What I hope God looks like. He's an amazing guy. John Pham is like, yeah, he's genuinely one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my life. It's kind of frightening. And, you know, it's good. I think it's good, you know, because it's good to have someone to talk to when you need to talk to someone.
And that's
you know what I mean? Like, John, the relationship with John is good because John's not going to say anything about what's on my desk, you know?
Yeah.
Unless I bug him about it, which is awesome, you know, because I just want to see if something... I mean, as a cartoonist, it's not even like trying to get a drawing right, because you know when a drawing looks bad. It's more, does this read? Does this joke make sense? Does this transition make sense? These types of things, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's good just to have any pair of eyes kind of nearby, you know? I guess most cartoonists use their girlfriend or their wives, like, you know, constantly bugging them. So I get to bug John about it.
Well, and that's a good thing to have someone to bug, because I guess cartooning is one of the most solitary mediums, so...
Maybe.
One of the solitary mediums, we'll say that.
One of them, but people say that, but I'm always like, if you're a writer, you're sitting in a room writing. If you're a painter, you're standing in a room painting. I think we cartoonists, we complain a lot.
There we go. It's that whole storytelling technique when you have a drawing of someone complaining. See, if it's a book, it's not so obvious, but when you have a picture of Harvey Pekar, you know, it makes it more obvious.
Totally. Totally.
Well, thanks for taking the time to join me today, Sammy.
Sure. Pleasure.
That was Sammy Harcum. His book is Kramer's Urgot, Book 7, and it's a fantastic tome of wonderment and goodness. Check it out.
I'm drunk on a couch in Nashville, in a duplex near the reservoir, and every single thought is like a punch in the face. I'm like a rabbit freezing on a star, on the wrong side of Sunday morning, shattered in the terrible light, working for a bankrupt circus on the wrong side of Saturday night. And I wanna be like water if I can, 'cause water doesn't give a damn. Water doesn't give a damn. Chased by a floating hatchet, you can't just shoot your way out and go. I could tell you things about this wallpaper that you'd never ever wanna know. Well, there's an altar in the valley for things in themselves as they are, and the triumph of the obstacle and horse leg swastikas. I wanna take a ride on the back of a sunbird up into the highest number, up into the highest number. Doesn't get